We're going to turn to God's Word, and we've got a longer reading this evening in Book of 1 Samuel. We're going to read chapters 5 and 6, then just the very beginning of chapter 7 as well. So I think John and Linda are coming to read to us. We're going to read 1 Samuel chapters 5 and 6.
Starting at 1 Samuel chapter 5, verse 1. After the Philistines had captured the Ark of God, they took it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. Then they carried the Ark into Dagon's temple and set it beside Dagon. When the people of Ashdod rose early the next day, there was Dagon, fallen on his face on the ground before the Ark of the Lord. They took Dagon and put him back in his place. But the following morning, when they arose, there was Dagon, fallen on his face on the ground before the ark of the Lord. His head and hands had been broken off and were lying on the threshold. Only his body remained. That is why to this day neither the priests of Dagon nor any others who enter Dagon's temple at Ashdod step on the threshold. The Lord's hand was heavy on the people of Ashdod and its vicinity. He brought devastation on them and afflicted them with tumours. When the people of Ashdod saw what was happening, they said, "The Ark of God of Israel must not stay here with us, because his hand is heavy on us and on Dagon our God." So they called together all the rulers of the Philistines and asked them, "What shall we do with the Ark of the God of Israel?" They answered, "Let the Ark of the God of Israel be moved to Gath." So they moved the ark of the God of Israel. But after they'd moved it, the Lord's hand was against that city, throwing it into a great panic. He afflicted the people of the city, both young and old, with outbreak of tumours. So they sent of the ark of God to Ekron. As the ark of God was entering Ekron, the people of Ekron cried out, "They have brought the ark of the God of Israel round here to kill us and our people." So they called together all the rulers of the Philistines and said, "Send the ark of the God of Israel away. Let it go back to its own place, or it will kill us and our people. For death has filled the city with panic." God's hand was very heavy on it. Those who did not die were afflicted with tumours, and the outcry of the city went up to heaven.
Continuing in chapter 6. When the Ark of the Lord had been in Philistine territory for 7 months, the Philistines called for the priests and the diviners and said, "What shall we do with the Ark of the Lord? Tell us how we should send it back to its place." They answered, "If you return the Ark of the God of Israel, do not send it back to him without a gift. By all means send a guilt offering to him. Then you will be healed, and you will know why his hand has not been lifted from you." The Philistines asked, "What guilt offering should we send to him?" They replied, 5 gold tumours and 5 gold rats, according to the number of the Philistine rulers, because the same plague has struck both you and your rulers. Make models of the tumours and of the rats that are destroying the country, and give glory to Israel's God. Perhaps he will lift his hand from you and your gods and your land. Why do you harden your hearts as the Egyptians and Pharaoh did? When Israel's God dealt harshly with them, they did not send the Israelites out so that they did they not send the Israelites out so that they could go on their way. Now then, get a new cart ready, with 2 cows that have calved and never been yoked. Hitch the cows to the cart, but take their calves away and pen them up. Take the Ark of the Lord and put it on the cart, and in a chest beside it, put the gold objects you are sending back to him as a guilt offering. Send it on its way, but keep watching it. If it goes up to its own territory towards Beth Shemesh, then the Lord has brought this great disaster on us. But if it does not, then we shall know that it was not his hand that struck us, but that it happened to us by chance. So they did this. They took two such cows and hitched them to the cart and penned up their calves. They placed the ark of the Lord on the cart, and along with it the chest containing the gold rats and the models of the tumours. Then the cows went straight up towards Beth Shemesh, keeping on the road and lowing all the way. They did not turn to the right or to the left. The rulers of the Philistines followed them as far as the border of Beth Shemesh. Now the people of Beth Shemesh were harvesting their wheat in the valley. And when they looked up and saw the ark, they rejoiced at the sight. The cart came to the field of Joshua of Beth Shemesh, and there it stopped beside a large rock. The people chopped up the wood of the cart and sacrificed the cows as a burnt offering to the Lord. The Levites took down the ark of the Lord, together with the chest containing the gold objects, and placed them on a large rock. On that day, the people of Beth Shemesh offered burnt offerings and made sacrifices to the Lord. The five rulers of the Philistines saw all this and then returned that same day to Ekron. These are the gold tumours the Philistines sent as a guilt offering to the Lord, one each for Ashdod, Gaza, Ashkelon, Gath, and Ekron. And the number of the gold rats was according to the number of the Philistine towns belonging to the five rulers, the 45 towns with their country villages. The large rock on which the Levites set the ark of the Lord is a witness to this day in the field of Joshua of Beth Shemesh. But God struck down some of the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh, putting 70 of them to death, because they looked into the ark of the Lord. The people mourned because of the heavy blow the Lord had dealt them. And the people of Beth Shemesh asked, "Who can stand in the presence of the Lord, this holy God? To whom will the ark go up from here?" Then they sent messengers to the people of Kiriath Jearim, saying, "The Philistines have returned the ark of the Lord. Come down and take it up to your town." So the men of Kiriath Jearim came and took up the ark of the Lord. They brought it to Abinadab's house on the hill and consecrated Eleazar his son to guard the ark of the Lord. The ark remained at Kiriath Jearim a long time, 20 years in all.
Thank you. Well, keep a finger in that place. We'll be thinking about that great story a little bit later. Well, it would be great if you got your Bibles open at that passage we read in 1 Samuel chapters 5 and 6. This is, I love this story for many reasons. One of them is just because this story is a kind of Bible passage that many Christians don't realize exists in the Bible, or a type of Bible story many Christians don't realize exists in the Bible. And because I think that genre is comedy. It's comedy. I led a Bible study on this passage actually several years ago at a church in Essex. And I asked people there how they responded to the story. We just read it through and said, well, how do you respond? What's your response to that? And there's an older lady there, a lovely Christian lady. You know, she spent many years as a missionary in the Congo and things like that. And she spoke up very apologetically and said, well, I'm afraid. It makes me want to laugh. So to her surprise, I assured her that I think that's exactly how we're supposed to respond to this story. The way that the Philistines encounter the Ark of the Lord, it's written in such a way that kind of reminds me, sort of going back to the telly of my youth. Do you remember, you might have seen, you know, the Chuckle Brothers, you know, to me, to you, keep passing it around, running around Israel. The author wants us to laugh at their stupidity. As they find out the hard way how woefully inadequate their expectations of Israel's God are. Or if you want another way of thinking of it, it's a bit like, you know, reading the story like this, the way it's told, it's a bit like when you're at a football game and your team isn't doing very well at all. And so the other supporters, once they start chanting, "You're not very good, you're not very good." That's kind of Israel's kind of telling its story with that kind of attitude towards the Philistines, isn't it? There's times when the Bible writers sort of invite us to point and laugh at the stupidity and the blindness of sinful humanity. And our passage here is one of those occasions, I think. But we need to be warned as we approach that passage and as we point and laugh. You know, the old saying, remember when you're pointing at somebody else, remember, what have you got? You've got three fingers pointing back at yourself. That may indeed be our experience as we watch the story unfold here in 1 Samuel chapters 5 and 6. So where are we then? You've got ballpark figures of about 1000 BC, 1000 years before the arrival of Jesus. We're heading towards the arrival of King Saul and then, of course, great King David of David and Goliath fame. And Israel is in a mess. They've been said it was God's chosen special people, a special relationship with him, and they have made a colossal hash of it. In fact, they've gone into battle in the previous chapter against their old enemies, the Philistines, and they were roundly defeated, which was a worrying sign of their distance from God. And we begin to see why, perhaps, when, as the story unfolds in chapter 4, so what we're going to do about this? Well, instead of turning to God for guidance, they decide to bring the Ark of God along into battle with them. Now, the Ark was the most sacred object they had. It was the symbol of God's presence with them. It was, if you like, God gave them almost a sign of, it was sort of God's location on earth almost. We know that God can't be restricted like that, but it was a sign of how specially present he was with them. And instead of seeking him, they just brought the box that, well, if we bring God into the battle, we'll be okay. Which is just a sign of how distant their relationship with God had become. They're just treating him like sort of a God in the box that you wheel out when you've got a problem and you want him to sort it out. But God is very clear. He is not going to be insulted by that kind of mistreatment. And so the Israelites, in fact, are devastatingly defeated by the Philistines. And the Ark is captured by the Philistines. And so they cart it off to the temple of their god, Dagon, as a trophy of war. And that's where we pick up the story here at the beginning of chapter 5. And first of all, in the first 5 verses, we have Dagon being confronted with the God of Israel. And we were beginning in a position of total disaster, it would seem. The very sign of God's presence with his people has been carted off by a triumphant enemy. And to everybody concerned, that sent just one message. The God of Israel had been defeated by Dagon, the God of the Philistines. That's how they would have read it. So naturally, the Philistines take the ark back to Ashdod, one of their cities, and put it in Dagon's temple as a trophy of their God's mighty victory. Except when they turn the lights out and go home, something remarkable happens. Because when they turn up again the next morning, what has happened? The great statue of Dagon has fallen on his face on the floor before the Ark of God. Well, that's a little disturbing, isn't it? If that's what's happened to your God. But never mind, it's just one of those things. Surely, the poor Dagon, poor chap, pick him up, dust him off, put him back on his pedestal, he'll be okay. But another day rolls round, and the next morning, well, you've got an unparalleled disaster, because not only has Dagon again fallen off his pedestal and his face down on the floor, his head and his hands have fallen off in the fall. And they're rolling about in the doorway of the temple. It may be the day before there's been that nagging doubt. Well, that wasn't Dagon bowing to the God of Israel, was it? No, it's just one of those things. Brush it off. But the next day, well, there's really no doubt, is there? This time the message is unmistakable. Your God isn't just bowing to the God of Israel. He's been destroyed by the God of Israel. His head's been cut off. And he's utterly useless. His hands have fallen off too. Well, you can't do anything without your hands, can you? A symbolic message of Dagon's complete helplessness before the God of Israel. Poor old Dagon, eh? So then, in the bulk of our story, from chapter 5, verse 6 to chapter 6, verse 16, you've got the Philistines then. The Philistines themselves being confronted with the God of Israel. Because Dagon may have lost his hands, and he's powerless, if you like. But the hand of the Lord, verse 6, is still very active in Philistia. You get that phrase coming back again. Dagon's hands fell off, but the hand of the Lord is heavy on the people of Israel. Not on the people of Philistia, sorry. And this deadly plague of painful tumors breaks out in Ashdod. Something that the Philistines see as God's hand against them. Look, he's dealt with Dagon, now he's coming for the rest of us. The Philistines were kind of a confederation of five city-states. And so they get all the leaders together, quick, emergency council, what are we going to do about this? What are we going to do with the Ark of the God of Israel, since the God of Israel seems to be not nearly as defeated as we thought he was, verse 8. And this grand, sort of, to me, to you, farce sort of begins around the land of Philistia. And sort of, you read the story, it's one of those things that feels like it should be, if it was a film, it would be one of those things when they do the chase scenes, they're all running around, and it's all sped up, with some sort of chase music going on or something. Sort of told like that, isn't it? Well, move it to the town of Gath. Let's go to Gath, is the decision of the leaders. Maybe the Lord of Gath felt that, he and his people, we could handle the God of Israel. We're made of sterner stuff. We've got more powerful gods than those namby-pamby Ashdodites. But actually, chapter 5, verse 9, the Lord's hand is found to be just as painfully heavy against Gath as it was in Ashdod, and the same plague falls, leading the city into panic. And so the ark sent off again. They sent it to Ekron. But the people of Ekron have got wise to that. You can sort of imagine them sort of running out of the city. It's like, get that thing away from here. We don't want it anywhere near. And so once again, get all the leaders together. Another quick council. Just get rid of this terrifying God, will you? Because already, verse 11, the plague is taking hold in Ekron. So you see, what should have been, if you like, the ultimate walk of shame, as the ark is carted around Philistia as a trophy of war, a sign of defeat, turns out to be a kind of victory parade for the Lord through his enemy territory. He spreads panic amongst his enemies wherever he goes. Things are getting desperate. Last verse there of chapter 5. Those who did not die were afflicted with tumors, and the outcry of the city went up to heaven. So if it gets that desperate, you call in your religious experts, chapter 6, verse 2, for a consultation. The penny's starting to drop. They're starting to finally realize who this God is, what he's like. There's a little sort of indication of that in the way the story's told. Because now the Philistines change the way they refer to the ark. It's no longer just the ark of the God of Israel. It's the ark of the Lord. Capital letters. Lord. And I guess many of you know that when you see Lord in capital letters there in our English Bibles, that's translating God's name, which we usually pronounce as Yahweh. And just as when you get to know someone, you learn their name. Well, the Philistines are starting to get to know Yahweh, through these terrifying experiences. You see, they now know that Yahweh is not some kind of God in a box, like Israel thought, and like they had thought, a God who could be, if you like, kept safely and then wheeled out to help get me what I want. They now knew that Yahweh could not be compared to Dagon or any of their so-called gods, that actually Yahweh is in a league of his own with no rivals. They know there's no way he can be contained or controlled, something they've discovered to their own peril. And so now they must honor Yahweh, which is why they come up with this scheme of making, it's a strange gift to our mind, but they thought 5 gold tumors and 5 gold rats, as a symbol of what God, this God had done to them. Let's make a golden present for him to try and honor him, to try and appease him. And these gifts are put on a brand new cart, pulled by cows that have never pulled a cart before. You know, everything's suitably special to honor him. And then just as the final nail in the coffin of doubt, to double check that it wasn't just one of those things that happens now and again. Do you notice what cows they used? Cows who are new mothers, who've been separated from their calves. So you see, these cows are going to go only in one direction, aren't they? Straight back to their calves. And where does this cart go? The cows take it straight on the road to Beth Shemesh, the border town of Israel. The cows lowing all the way, almost as though they're going against their will, just to be greeted by those overjoyed Israelites as the Lord, if you like, rides back into town in victory with the spoils of war in his cart. The message is very clear for the rulers, the Philistine rulers watching in chapter 6, verse 16, as they saw all this and returned home to Ekron. Yahweh is not a God that you mess with. He's not a God that you take for granted, that you treat as though you're in control and he'll do what you ask him when you ask him. Thank you very much. It's a message that we need to hear today, isn't it? As we seek to live as the people of God today. Our society wants to say that, you know, every opinion is valid, especially on religious matters. Yeah, we should be tolerant. And by that, they don't necessarily mean tolerant. They just mean don't disagree. You're supposed to believe that God has not spoken. God has not shown himself to us. So everybody's opinion is equally valid. The thing is, if God has revealed himself to us, what then? You see, the Bible very clearly says, Yahweh has no rivals. He will not allow himself to be considered one option amongst many. He's not going to be messed with by those who want to tell him perhaps that his ways and his commands are old-fashioned and no longer acceptable. So you see, this is a message that he commands us graciously and urgently to take to the world, because one day all of us will be confronted with this God of Israel, ready or not. And just as his hand was heavy on the Philistines, many in their sinful rebellion against him will find out too late that, in the words of Hebrews 10, it is a fearful thing to fall into the hand of the living God without our sin dealt with. What a great triumphant end to the story. God's victory parade around the Philistine territory. Except the story didn't end there, did it? Like a skillful storyteller, you see, we've been carried along laughing at the stupidity of the Philistines. And then with this deft twist, our storyteller shows us actually even God's own people need to be confronted by the reality of who God is. And so at the end of our passage, in chapter 6, verse 17 to the end, the Israelites are confronted with the God of Israel. So you've got all these scenes of celebration, Beth Shemesh on the border town. You know, the Ark of God has come back to us. That is fantastic news. All of a sudden, the scene changes and terror breaks out. Verse 19, God struck down some of the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh, putting 70 of them to death because they looked into the Ark of the Lord. The people mourned because of the heavy blow the Lord had dealt with them. The Ark was the most sacred object in Israel. It was the representation of God's own presence with him. It was indescribably holy. No one, and I mean no one, was allowed to touch it. Only the high priest got to even see it. And that was once a year. Whenever it was being carried anywhere else, it was always covered. But the men of Beth Shemesh clearly didn't think that approaching God was a big deal. They could just sort of saunter up and have a poke around in the ark to satisfy their own curiosity. You see, we began with Israel treating God as this kind of, you know, God in a box who's very convenient. And now we see God's definitive assessment of that kind of attitude towards him. It's actually only when they call in the people of Kiriath-Jearim in verse 21, being a little economical with the truth there. Not leaving us wondering whether they're actually just going to be as bad as the Philistines and keep passing the ark around. Well, no, finally, the people of Kiriath-Jearim treat that great symbol of God's presence with appropriate reverence. They appoint a priest to look after it. In chapter 7, verse 1, only then the things calm down. Could it be that we, like the Israelites, need to be confronted with the God of Israel through this passage? Could it be that, you know, God uses the sort of humor of the story to, if you like, whip the rug out from under our feet whilst we aren't looking and leave us with the painful realization that all too often I'm no different? You see, Yahweh, in all his awesome majesty, is not just the Old Testament God, as though that's a different kind of God. He is our God too. He is the same God throughout the Bible and throughout history. Jesus is the revelation of this God. He has not changed. Sadly, neither is human nature. Yet we still naturally opt for our own comfortable gods that we can take for granted. You know, even as Christians, we can so quickly domesticate God. We have awesome privileges calling God our Father. But we can even begin to take that as some sort of over-familiarity, as though he's someone who's just always there for us, and forget that he is the great and mighty and awesome God too. You know, Hebrews 10 tells us, by his death, Jesus opened a new and life-giving way through the curtain into the most holy place, the place where the ark was kept in the temple. In other words, you know, we can come right into God's presence because of Jesus. And that is awesome. We can get to know Yahweh as our God. We can share real closeness in our relationship with him. We get to know him without the fear of the judgment that was inflicted on Beth Shemesh. But because we have such freedom, we can easily begin to take it for granted. It should be a cause for awe, for wonder, for heartfelt adoration every single day, that we can approach God so freely, that we can know him so intimately as our Father who is in heaven. Because he is still the almighty and awesome God, Yahweh, who's made known here in 1 Samuel. And so he's to be approached, and to be spoken of with the deepest reverence. What are the attitudes of our heart towards God? Have we become overly familiar? As though that's no big deal. Or are we simply awed and astounded by it? We need to consider the attitudes of our own hearts toward God, don't we? But also it means that if this God is our God, then we should have great expectations of God too. What he may do in us, what he may do through us. But then again, I have to ask, well, is that really what I want, or have I settled for something less? I heard a really remarkable message once. There's a retired pastor from Pontefract speaking about how God worked in incredible ways in a number of churches around the country, sort of 40 years ago or so. The incredible power of God they saw manifested in amazing ways. And he closed his talk with words that his wife had come out with just in conversation just before he'd given this talk, I think. They'd been talking about what so many Christians want. When we ask God continually to bless us and to bless our churches, what are we actually asking God for? And she said, you know, if only they knew what a visitation of God is like. But all they're looking for is a really good church. We just want everything to be great. We don't necessarily want God to move in power among us. If God began to move among us in true revival, would we be those who are rejoicing or those who are backing away? Because when God begins to work in amazing ways, he's breaking into people's lives in fresh ways, saving people in amazing ways, the loudest complaints and criticisms tend to come from people who are already in the church. Because seeing people whose hearts have been set on fire with a passion for this God highlights the lukewarmness of my own heart. We might not want a God like Yahweh who might upset the way things are. We need to ask ourselves, have you and I perhaps turned God in our own minds to a kind of God in a box without even realizing it? Listen, so we must repent because we're bringing dishonor upon him. Because our spiritual lives and our influence will be accordingly feeble until we do repent. Because God is not in the business of playing around or settling for our little agendas just because we want him to. We don't want to be those, like the Philistines, propping up our own little Dagons, the things that we really live for. Because it took something pretty big for the Philistines to finally wake up, didn't it? But then by contrast, consider William Carey, famous as the great pioneer missionary to India. He was a pastor of a Grace Baptist Church like this one back in the 18th century, and he had a big view of God, a view of God so big that he was burdened that the whole world should hear about Jesus. Because, you know, this God, he's not just the God of Israel, he's not just the God of the English or the Grace Baptist or anyone else. Everyone should get to hear of him. And his outlook is wonderfully summarized in his famous sermon. Many of you will have heard this before, where his two points were these. Expect great things from God, and then attempt great things for God. Now, a lot of the other pastors who were there, they really didn't share his enthusiasm. They were good at talking up the power and the might of God, but when push came to shove, they weren't really up for doing anything about it. In other words, they didn't have overly great expectations of God. So their attitude betrayed the fact that they had domesticated God in some ways, that he was safely what we could talk about and preach about in our chapels. And so, well, those people are largely forgotten to history. But Carey and a few sort of like-minded friends were so gripped by their great expectations of what this God could do that they came up with this novel idea of a missionary society, which they duly founded, And Carey became a lifelong missionary in India. And through his vision, through his great expectations of God, the modern missionary movement was born, which has sent thousands of missionaries right around the world so that hundreds and hundreds of thousands have heard of Jesus Christ. The great news that Jesus saves, and they become a part of God's glorious kingdom. And so we remember and honor a man like William Carey. You see how much difference it makes? The way that we think of our God. You see why we must be confronted by the God of Israel here in 1 Samuel 5 and 6. He's told us in a way that gets us smiling, but actually the question behind it is dead serious. How great is your God?